This is Mae Brussel. It is the second half of a program called World Watchers. If you picked it up in the middle, it is program number 812. I want to apologize for new listeners who hear me use a lot of names such as Griffin Bell or Scott Pierce or Donald Reagan in terms of E.F. Hutton, and I use a lot of names in a given broadcast. But I've been on the air, this is my 17th year. Many people subscribe to the tapes or listen regularly, and so that I can get as much new information in as possible, I refer to back broadcasts or names that I've used frequently on the air, and the back broadcasts are available by tape cassette. If you want them, you can write to me for them, but I can't keep filling in every detail because it would take that whole hour to just give the background of the person I'm talking about. So I have to assume when you listen to World Watchers that you're pretty sophisticated and have an idea of who I'm talking about. And if not, just get an overview of some of the things that are happening. And one of the things that is happening is that America is not only going fascist in so many ways it's hard to keep up with them now, but the Germans and the Japanese are emerging. And people like Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz, who worked for Bechtel Corporation for many, many years as chairman, director, and so forth, were building the main buildings and contracts in Saudi Arabia, a violently anti-Semitic country that wanted to wipe out Israel. And now they're arranging for Egypt on the other side of Israel to start making these brutal tanks that could pulverize Israel in very short time. Now, I went to visit the bishop this last October. It was October the 15th. And this is the letter I gave to him, and I gave him a three-hole notebook, as I say, with about 65 sheets of broadcasts I did about the Vatican, and I left them with him. And then after I did that a couple of months ago, the two Secret Service men came to the house from down San Jose, and we visited, and they had the notebook in their hand. The bishop didn't keep it or read it. I'm sure he didn't copy it. He gave it to the Secret Service. And they talked about the security of the Pope, and I assured them that I'm not any danger to the Pope, but I have a right to express some anger, and I wasn't going to just put it on the air. I wanted to tell the bishop personally. So apply what I said in writing to the bishop in September to his visiting and grinning with Mr. Waldheim this past weekend. For Bishop Shuboda, nobody in his right mind should forget the past if the past goal was a 1,000-year Reich. The people of the past, such as Hermann Abst of the Deutsche Bank and of the board of IG Farben, are still working in the Vatican with Pope John Paul II. Men such as Abst, and Abst in particular, is. Baron von Weizsäcker was liaison of Adolf Hitler to the Vatican. Richard von Weizsäcker, Jr. is current president of Germany. Weizsäcker and Helmut Kohl literally forced the president of the United States to attend ceremonies at Bitburg Cemetery, burial place of many Waffen-SS. François Jeannot, financier for Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels, hired attorney Jacques Vergès when the trial for Klaus Barbie was to begin. Barbie's passage to Bolivia was because of Vatican assistance. Jeannot hired Vergès as attorney for recent terrorists in Paris, such as George Abdullah. That's the Direct Action Group, which is a right-left disguised as left terrorist group. The Vatican entertains, recognizes Mr. Arafat of the PLO, also Iraq Grand Mufti, the heirs to the Grand Mufti. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was in the Waffen-SS, Hitler's SS. And I said they are currently bombing, hijacking, killing, and they are the world's worst terrorists. The past is not dead. Jeannot and his Knights of Malta from the Vatican connections talk of a 1,000-year Reich surviving, and they're doing very well without even having another war. Pope John Paul II worked for Solvay Chemical, which is IG Farben, during the war. When the Vatican Bank and Paul Marcinkus became connected by way of Stiebaum, that organization with Henry R. Sand, to gun running, to contracting for atomic bombs for Saudi Arabia, to drug traffic, Pope John Paul II brought to the Vatican Bank his old boss paymaster, Hermann Abst, paymaster for the Waffen-SS and IG Farben. The past wasn't buried. The past is now. Sincerely, Mae Brussel. And as I say, I gave him a lot of sheets. I gave him one from 1978. That's 9 years ago, broadcast 362, with a map of Poland and references of Adolf Hitler's books and books on I.G. Farben, because John Paul II worked for I.G. Farben. I gave a chronology of the various popes, which of course he had, and books and articles on the poisoning of John Paul I, Los Angeles Times, October 6, 1978. Amazingly large number of people are raising the possibility of poison in connection with Pope John Paul's death, and I gave him a lot of articles on the murder of John Paul coming from New York Times and Wall Street Journal, L.A. Times. And then I gave him some sheets of broadcasts going back to 1978 of Martin Bormann and how he left Europe with the help of the Vatican and went down to South America, and information about Michele Sindona and his working investing the Vatican bank money. And Michele Sindona is part of a very important triangle working with David Graver from Argentina and Robert Vesco, who's very much involved in the Central American operations, and the Vatican and J. Peter Grace and the Catholic organizations have a big role in maintaining this literal slave-labor relationship of people to their own countries down in South and Central America. And then I gave him some material from various articles and sources, and I said, as this goes back to 1979, watch this Pope's political acts or his non-acts towards fascists. Don't be fooled by baby kissing, ground kissing, public relations handouts. Nobody could live under the Nazis the way he did and see and smell so much death and torture under his eyes and nose, because he worked at Auschwitz, where the mass exterminations went on. He could not be so violently anti-communist and never speak out against the Nazis. Well, since then, he has entered one synagogue in Rome, which no pope has ever done, and he can always say, I entered the synagogue. Now, one other article, it should be a warning if what I said about this pope is true, or the way this country is going, our Defense Department and so on. There was an article from Reuters published in San Francisco Chronicle, June the 16th, titled, Japanese Mogul Underwriting Space Center. The University of Houston, Texas will get $3 million from a Japanese foundation funded by Ryosha Sasakawa. $1 million has come in from Japan Shipbuilding Industry Foundation. This experimental architectural center will be renamed in Houston, Texas for the space program area, the Sasakawa International Center for Space Architecture, in honor of the foundation's 87-year-old chairman, Ryosha Sasakawa. Sasakawa, according to this article, is interested in the design of space stations and stations on the moon, bases on the moon, and vehicles that take humans to Mars and to the moon. Recently, Ryosha Sasakawa contributed to the eradication of smallpox and got the United Nations Peace Medal. Now, Ryosha Sasakawa is one of the persons very active in AIDS. Elizabeth Taylor had a party or went to Japan to see him with AIDS, and he's putting a lot of money into AIDS research. The San Francisco Progress has a picture that somebody sent to me of Dianne Feinstein shaking the hands of Ryosha Sasakawa. This 87-year-old is very alert and very active. This was published May 31st. Humanitarian visits City Hall. Mayor Dianne Feinstein shakes hands with widely renowned philanthropist Ryosha Sasakawa. He intends to present $1 million to the American Foundation for AIDS Research and pledge at least $8 million more every year for a cure for AIDS until it's found. Over the last 12 years, he donated approximately $12 billion to charities. In return, the mayor gave him a package, which he had in his hand, which was a piece of cable from the Golden Gate Bridge. That's what you give to the man who has everything. And for those of you who don't know why Ryosha Sasakawa would be working on Mars and space stations, remember the book Alternative 3? I did about 4 broadcasts on that, written by Leslie Watkins, that the purpose of the space stations was genocide and to get rid of 80% of the Earth's population was one of the catches involved in using for some way of dispersing population. But you don't have to ship people on a one-way trip to Mars. That's a little expensive. All you have to do, maybe, is reduce the Earth's population with something like AIDS that gets rid of all the people in Africa and then Asia, and all those places that you don't want the people around, but you want the resources and the oil. The earth is shrinking, and we're short of resources. And Ryosha Sasakawa is busy in AIDS. He's busy in Mars and moons. And let me just remind you, for those of you who forget it, because this was a long time ago, there was an article in 1983 again. These years go so fast. We're 5 years back, by Alec Dubrow and David Kaplan in the Village Voice on Ryosha Sasakawa. This article details Sasakawa's early work in the 30s, setting up assassination teams against politicians, identical to what Adolf Hitler was doing with the Freikorps, how they were setting up moderate government officials by the political party, the Kikuchi Taishito, I don't know if I pronounced that right, and that there were plots against all the high officials and murdered those people, probably in the way of invading China and continuing, leading to the Pearl Harbor attack against the United States. Sasakawa was involved in blackmail and spying. He was spying on those people who expressed dangerous thoughts about Japan's future. In 1936, in Fortune magazine, Sasakawa was charged with having made thousands of yen out of the general fear of intimidations and disloyalty. He was arrested by the Japanese authorities in 1942. He was elected to the Japanese wartime parliament, and he helped with the invasion of Southeast Asia. His party wore black shirts identical to Italy's Mussolini. They made fortunes identical to Italy, plundering strategic material from the war, went into China, and he had an operations legal section keeping the things that they had taken from all these countries, and was active with the fascist parties throughout the entire war. He was called by authorities a Class A war criminal. He was charged with crimes against the peace. He participated in conspiracies for preparation and aggression of war. And the U.S. report by Douglas MacArthur's staff said that he was hired by the Imperial Navy and played an important part in death watches and so forth. December the 11th, 1945, he was interrogated by MacArthur's staff. They finished their report on Sasakawa was 46 years old. And the summary said he appears to be a man potentially dangerous to Japan's political future. He has been squarely behind Japanese military policies of aggression and anti-foreignism for more than 20 years. He's a man of wealth. He's not too scrupulous about its uses. He wants continued power, and he's not above wearing any new cloak that opportunism may bring him. He was released with 18 others. He was never brought to trial. He spent 3 years in prison, and then they were all released, and then he begins working with the United States government and U.S. intelligence, makes a deal just like Klaus Barbie. So the fascists from the 30s continued right on to 1987, and the stated goals of one in terms of what to do with wiping out population, I'm sure, is just absolutely coincidental. Do you believe that with his interest in AIDS or in Mars, or fits in his opportunity to use disease as a method of endearing himself to various people, continues to be a threat given his mindset and the track record of these people, of who they worked with before and continue to work with now at the present time. Now, a week ago, June 19th, I was shocked to read an article by James Kilpatrick titled, "If Only Reagan Had a Chance to Appoint More Justices." I was shocked by the tone of the article. It said Ronald Reagan has had his full share of disappointments over the past 6.5 years. Federal deficits remain large. Farm problems grow worse. The trade imbalance is a headache. The Iran-Contra affair is a mess. But one disappointment may outrank all the others. Reagan has been only able to name 2 new members of the U.S. Supreme Court. By this time, if we were to take history as a guide, he should have had better luck. In a little more than 3 terms in office, he cites what Roosevelt did and Harding. Reagan, he said, has only had Sandra Day O'Connor and Antonin Scalia to carry his flag into the 21st century. It seems hardly fair, writes James Kirkpatrick. After all, William Brennan is 81 in April. Lewis Powell will be 80 in September. Thurgood Marsh will be 79 next month. Harry Blackmun turned 79 in November. It does not seem reasonable, or is it unreasonable to suppose that by this time, some of these distinguished gentlemen might have retired or been summoned to a yet higher court. There they sit, unperturbed, contented as frogs on a lily pad, while time passes and opportunity shrinks. And 7 days later, The court is rearranged, and now we're in a question of who to replace with Justice Powell, and he steps down. He may be sick of colon cancer, he may not be sick of colon cancer, but he has stepped down. What were the decisions of the he's almost liberal, Mr. Powell. Last week they passed a decision that if you have private property facing the ocean that people can't pass, have a pathway through your property to have access to the beach. Do you know what that means? And if you haven't figured it out, sit a while and get yourself a wading pool at Sears Roebuck. There's another decision, San Francisco Chronicle, this past week. High Court reaffirms military immunity. LSD dose soldier was given, a person in the military was given LSD without his knowledge for purposes of experimentation. And the court voted 5-4 that he has immunity, the government has immunity from law, that in the military service that you have the right to be experimented upon, that your life is subject to the government. This man said his life was nearly ruined by the secret tests. And Justice Antonio Scalia, Reagan's appointed justice, declared for the court that permitting this lawsuit, that when you're given LSD or poisoned by your government to be tested upon, would disrupt the military regime, This person said his life was ruined. It was nearly ruined by these secret tests. He has no recourse. In a bitter dissent, Justice William Brennan said the government's conduct reminded him of Nazi doctors who treated humans like laboratory animals in conducting medical experiments. Brennan noted that the Nuremberg War Crimes trial determined that experimentation with unknowing human subjects is morally and legally unacceptable. And John Paul Stevens said agreed about this. But Sandra Day, Reagan's appointee, said that this is her statement in a separate dissent. That she said, conduct of this type alleged in this case is so far beyond the bounds of human decency that as a matter of law, it sadly can't be considered as part of a military mission. You can't protect people who are given chemicals by the government because it's not even hardly possible. And this person said the purpose of the test was to examine the use of gas masks and protective clothing, and that he was at Aberdeen Proving Ground, and he said the real intent was his unwitting reaction to psychedelic substance, lysergic acid, diethylamide, and the government was interested in finding whether the drugs could be used to force captured soldiers to talk freely. And on 4 occasions, he drank LSD, and the experience nearly destroyed him, and he had hallucinations and episodes of it, and he'd wake up from sleep at night and beat his wife and children, couldn't recall the incident, and his mind had been affected. He lives now in Florida, and in 1969, he was having problems with his family. He learned about the experiments in 1975, what they were doing to them, and the Supreme Court says, we don't pay you back anything. You belong to the country. We can do anything we want with your head. And the decision was passed that the Supreme Court owes nobody anything for what they do to them. And at the same time, the Supreme Court ruled that families of workers exposed to nuclear tests can't sue the U.S. court. Survivors of government employees who develop cancer from radiation of atmospheric nuclear testing cannot sue the government or its contractees for damages. In a landmark decision that could bar legal compensation for 250,000 workers exposed during atomic weapons tests, the court ruled that they're not going to take responsibility for those cancers. You're on your own, and even if you died of leukemia or leukemia your family did, and they had follow-ups, that's too bad. Tough buns. We're not going to be interested in you. So what has happened with Richard Nixon's appointment of the court and Ronald Reagan's appointments to the court? You have a court that says your property can block the ocean, your property can, your government can drug you, and it can put chemicals in the atmosphere. You have no recourse to sue. You live in the United States of America, and this is what we do. And if this is what we do, this is what you're going to get. Now, last week, I was all excited because Michael Ledeen would be a witness testifying. Ledeen can't be testifying for many, many reasons. I'll cite just one of them and do much more on this later. I don't want to do the remaining part of the broadcast. But a big story broke in 1985 about the arrest of persons involved in selling arms to Iran. It involved Paul Sciolla out here on the West Coast, who also uses the name Qatar. San Jose Mercury had a long story by Pete Carey and Alan Gaithright, published August the 9th, 1985. Alleged arms smuggler Paul Seychello met in Israel with Defense Minister Ariel Sharon in 1982 and devised a scheme to sell the captured weapons from the Israeli invasion in Lebanon to Iran. Seychello and six others were charged for a conspiracy to sell to Iran. That's Paul Cutter. And this Paul Cutter had gone to Israel with one of our top military generals. He visited the Jewish Institute of National Security, known as JINSA, J-I-N-S-A, and Michael Ledeen is very much a part of JINSA. He works with the Mossad and with the U.S. intelligence. JINSA was formed in 1976. There's 1,200 members, and among them is a Dr. Stephen Bryan, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense in 1981 and worked with the Mossad, and he continues to work with the Defense Department. Seychello worked with Lieutenant General Eugene Tighe, T-I-G-H-E, Jr., Chief of U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, from 1971 to 81, the DIA and the State Department and the Mossad and the National Security were sending arms to Iran during the period 1983, and they were told in Israel it was okay to do it. This is a long article about JINSA and about drug smuggling and how one group got arrested and the other were sending arms out of the White House. And, of course, the group that got arrested worked with Cyrus Hashemi, who was murdered in London, and I keep saying I'll update that story. Now, Michael Ledeen, I've mentioned on other programs, is a part of the Super Seize Me in Italy. He traveled with Henry Kissinger over in Italy, accompanied him in a time period in 1984. They were traveling together, and according to one article, this character, Michael Ledeen, was an American few know about, but he works closely with the Italian Secret Service, the Seize Me, the Super S, and Michael Ledeen, the former advisor of terrorism on the United States State Department, works under, this was 1984, under Alexander Haig as an operator of Super S, and along with Francesco Pazienza, who I've mentioned is now on trial for arranging the Bologna bombing with a whole gang of other Nazis, and they blamed it on the left. There's a new article out in New Times about the murder of Aldo Moro and linking him to the United States intelligence, to a man named Ronald Stark, who's now dead, who worked with Timothy Leary. And the relationship of the Aldo Moro murder goes, again, to Michael Ledeen and Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. And I'll do more on that later. But this Ledeen is so important that they don't dare let him come before the committee, and he didn't come because they don't want him to get too many perjury charges or get into heavy subjects that they would be forced to get into. There was another article by James Harrer and George Nicholas, Reagan's aides linked to spy scandal, and this is about JINSA and about Assistant Secretary of Defense Stephen Bryan and his Pentagon post, and Paul Seychello, Paul Cutter, and General Tighe, and that organization, JINSA. I'll spell out probably as soon as I can the Jonathan Institute and the JINSA, the connections of the Israeli Mossad to the United States Defense Department, but that only works for a short while. At this point, now the Defense Department will splinter off from Israel after the Iran-Contra affair, and they very blatantly announced that Egypt will be making these tanks for the United States in Egypt, and they have not consulted Israel. That article this morning is the first noticeable slap in the face, we don't care if you exist anymore, signal to the country of Israel. And Israel was doomed to get that anyway. The meeting of the Pope with Waldheim this week, the signals of this type of activity are all synchronized, all happening at the same time period in case Israel doesn't get the message. There's one article on Reagan's aides linked to spy scandal that involves Ledeen, says that reportedly in pursuit of Seychello's revelations, FBI boss William Webster discovered and alerted Ronald Reagan of the unavoidable question. George Shultz and his predecessor, Alexander Haig, and former CIA Deputy Director and Defense Undersecretary Frank Carlucci, who's now Chief of Staff, and General Tighe, Chief U.S. Arms Negotiator Ambassador Max Kampelman, and a dozen other military and civilian leaders have been working with key figures of JINSA in Israel and in the State Department, and are sending arms to Iran. This was published in 1985, but has to do with the shipment of Iran weapons going as soon as Ronald Reagan was president. the continuous shipment of arms to Iran, and then finally the arrest of these people after they were well known and worked together, Sashola, Ladine, Brian, and Teague, who all were board members of GINSA and worked together, this strange assortment of our Defense Department, a Mossad organization, and Michael Ladine, Ronald Reagan's links going back earlier to Iran and weapons and entering into Lebanon, Alexander Haig telling Israel they could do it and then take the weapons and sell the weapons to Iran, I believe was part and parcel of the deal of holding the hostages until after the election so Reagan could become president. Incidentally, if you have in these times, Barbara Honegger from Pacific Grove has a front page article on the hostage and the selling of the election and Ronald Reagan's transfer of arms by various means, the deals that were cut in 1980 that started in 1980. And, of course, this material about Ladine fits in, and I'll go more on that article in a little while. Many of you get in these times. If not, I suggest you try and subscribe to it because they're having very important material. One final article that I'll only have time for now. Warren Hinkle from the San Francisco Examiner yesterday is talking about the cover-ups of the Iran-Contra affair. And they're talking about Charles Cooper and his revelations and testimony about cover-ups of he spoke from the point of view of the Justice Department and the various changing of documents and the covering up, saying they were oil drills and they weren't, that they were actually arms for Iran. But Warren Hinkle, who was former publisher of Rampart's magazine in its robust, inquisitive days, said, "It is not the Contra cover-up number one that is bothering the people in Washington or in Miami, the Charles Cooper allegations or the others about the Ayatollah weapons being disguised as oil drills. The bigger cover-up is the one in Miami, cover-up number two, and it is yet to be presented to the country in any significant detail. Contragate number two is more damning to Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan because it ties the whole dirty business directly to illegal gun running in the United States and drug trafficking and profiteering on the part of the Contras, the Gipper's moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers." And this goes back to the story this morning about Gomez Rodriguez and the Medellin cartel and cocaine money, $10 million to the Contras. Warren Hinkle says, "Congressional testimony has established that Edwin Meese in 1986 put the brakes on and stopped an FBI justice investigation into illegal arms and drug shipments into Florida and Costa Rica involving the Contras and the Central Intelligence Agency. The motive was to hold off any adverse publicity until Congress voted $100 million to the Contras. The implications of the delay in terms of potential obstruction of justice are staggering. The general lack of attention on the part of the press of cover-up, too, may finally be the one that brings down the entire Contra house of cards on the Gipper's beautiful head and extends to the harassment of people who disclose the mess in the first place." That's Martha Honey and Tony Abrigan, who have filed a suit that the Christic Institute is handling. This article continues, "The Christic Institute in Washington, D.C., filed a whopper lawsuit 2 years ago on the part of two journalists injured in a bombing to get Eden Pastore in 1984. The suit laid out the secret government behind the Contra corruption and named all but the bid players, including Norris Secord and the rest of the reindeer. In late May, a Christic Institute secretary and lawyer were arrested in Costa Rica. They picked up a package at the post office that they thought was for them, for not knowing what it was, and there was dope in it, and immediately the Costa Rica police were there trying to blame them for receiving narcotics. Warren Hinkle concludes, "It was a clear setup and a clear harassment that the press opted to ignore. When you first stick your head in the sand, it is only a question of how far you want to go." And in terms of ignoring it, there was the testimony of Glenn Robinette that he was receiving from General Secord $4,000 a month, monthly expenses to get the dirt and to get Tony, Martha Honey and Tony Avergan and frame them. And this is a instance of their desperation. The problem is that that money, and he also came to a figure of $11,000, and the congressional committee asked Mr. Robinette, "What did you do with $11,000 down there? It's $1,000 to get to Costa Rica and back, or even $1,000 each way." Well, the point is that Robert Owen, a courier for these people, another defendant in this suit we have under sworn testimony was at the home of Robert K. Brown, the man who puts out Soldier of Fortune and hires the narcs. And the question that is, how careful do they have to be with Singh Laub and Brown and Owen and these hit teams working to protect their own lives besides having the drugs put on them? Well, our time is up now. I have to speak quickly to get in 1/10 of what I want to tell you in 1 hour. Forgive me for that. This is Mae Brussel. I'll be back with you next week to continue with World Watchers.